Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. We're talking now about the film Green Fire, which screens tonight here in Santa Fe at 6 o'clock at the State Land Office at 310 Old Santa Fe Trail. Joining me by telephone are Steve Dunsky. He's one of the filmmakers of the film Green Fire, which is about the great conservationist Aldo Leopold, and Kurt Meine, who is Leopold's biographer, and he is the narrator and one of the speakers in the film. And joining me here in the cafe is Scott Wilbur, executive director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy, one of the sponsors of this event tonight. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful to be here.
So let's start with you, Kurt. Tell us, who was Aldo Leopold? I suspect that many of our listeners have heard of him, some haven't, and some have only heard of him and don't really know who he is.
Well, most people, if they know Leopold, know him as the author of the book A Sand County Almanac, which is often described as the Bible of the environmental movement, certainly one of the most influential books about conservation and our relationship to the natural world. But behind that book is a fellow who had a career that marked him as, by many people's estimation, the most influential conservationist of the 20th century. He was trained as a forester, but he was known for many things, including his work in establishing the first wilderness areas as an advocate for wilderness, as a primary founder of the field of wildlife ecology and management. And so he was a scientist, he was a writer, he was a thinker, he was a teacher, he was a father in a remarkable family. And so he was a multifaceted fellow who left his mark in many, many different dimensions of conservation.
Steve Dunsky, why did you decide to make a film about him?
Well, actually, we were making another film called The Greatest Good, which was a history of the Forest Service. My wife and I and my colleague Dave Steinke, who are the filmmakers of Green Fire, work for the Forest Service. And in the early 2000s, we were working on a documentary called The Greatest Good, which was a history of the Forest Service and, by extension, kind of a history of conservation. And Aldo Leopold had about a 20-year career with the Forest Service. That's where he got his start professionally, and where he made some of his earliest discoveries and did some of his most important work in the Southwest. Actually, he was a forest supervisor at Tres Piedras, which is not too far from Santa Fe. And we were in the process of making that film. Leopold was a part of the film, and we got talking with the folks at the Aldo Leopold Foundation about partnering up to do what is really the first full documentary treatment of Aldo Leopold. So that process started in about 2005, and then about 3 years ago, we really got serious about making the film, and Green Fire is the result of that partnership, which has been a wonderful experience working with Kurt and the other folks at the foundation.
Aldo Leopold, well, tell us, first of all, where he was from and how he ended up in the Southwest and how his work here evolved.
The brief story there is that he was born and raised in Iowa, in the small city of Burlington, Iowa, on the Mississippi River, to a family that valued very much the experience of bringing their kids into the outdoors, and his father in particular was a keen hunter and sportsman who cared deeply about conservation before there was even a field of conservation. So as Aldo was growing up, he began to think about a career in this field. He ended up going off to the East to go to prep school and then ultimately to Yale and to the forestry school at Yale, which was one of the first and still one of the oldest forestry schools in the country, founded by the great founder of American forestry, Gifford Pinchot, and his family. It was the place to go and the place to be if you were interested in conservation 100 years ago. And it was also the time in the early progressive movement when the Forest Service was coming into its modern form in 1905, and national forests were being established throughout the West under the leadership of Pinchot and, of course, President Teddy Roosevelt. And the national forests in the Southwest were being staffed with all these young graduates, many of them from Yale. And Aldo was part of that campaign. He came west first to the Apache National Forest, what is now part of the Apache Sitgraves in eastern Arizona, and transferred over to the Carson Forest a couple years later, and would spend the next 15 years of his life in traveling actually all across the Southwest as part of the Forest Service.
I think that because we are dealing with climate change and with a kind of degradation of land, air, and water that's apparently unprecedented, we forget that as early as the late 19th century, there were tremendous problems that gave rise to these movements in the first place, conservation of land and the work that Leopold did. What are some of the ways in which land was being really degraded, and how did Aldo Leopold respond to that?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll answer it, and I'd be interested in Steve as someone who had to capture this on film, some of his thoughts. But yeah, Leopold was born in 1887, and for those of us who study environmental history, that means he was born in the very middle of this period of intense resource exploitation from the end of the Civil War up to the turn of the century. Those 35 years were a period, especially in the American Midwest, where just epic changes were taking place. The loss of the prairies all across the Midwest as they were converted to agriculture. The taking down of the great forests of the upper Great Lakes to build the houses and towns and farms of the Midwest. The loss of wetlands, the transformation of the river systems of the Midwest. The loss of wildlife, because there were no laws and there was no conservation movement yet to address these problems. And so Leopold again becomes part of this first generation to really take seriously the need to moderate our exploitation of the natural world. And so he becomes a part of a whole wave, a whole generation of people who, for the first time, begin to think about these issues at the larger scale, as you say. They didn't know about climate change in the same way we do, but they certainly had the same sense of the need for us to change our ways and to think anew and to understand in different ways the way the natural world works and the way our role within it has to change.
And I would add to that that, you know, in the Southwest, there were enormous changes that had taken place and were taking place on the landscape. You had the Europeans coming in, the Spanish originally coming in with a massive amount of sheep grazing, and we'll talk a little bit more later about Leopold's relationship to the sheep grazing families in your part of the country. But there was that, and then there was a massive influx of cattle in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s that really transformed the southwestern landscape dramatically. When we look out on those arroyos and so on today, they look like a natural system, but they're really not. There were great grasslands in New Mexico at one time, and those were all severely overgrazed. And it's only now that people are beginning to realize the possibility of restoring some of that capacity back into the ecosystem.
Aldo Leopold's work really centers around this idea of the land ethic, land not as a commodity to be exploited or a resource to be used, but as basically something we belong to. Tell us about the land ethic. What is the land ethic?
Well, the land ethic is actually Leopold's term that he finally came to rather late in his life, actually, to try to capture this new way of understanding, again, how the world works and how we work within it and the impact we have. He played around with these ideas a lot, and he was not alone. He was certainly a part of a broader community himself of people who were wrestling with these changing realities. But what it really reflected in Leopold's experience was the infusion of this new scientific understanding, first of all, especially through the emerging science of ecology. And for us, of course, we've all grown up with the term ecology. We all have a sense of what that science is and what it means for us. But for Leopold and his generation, it was new. It was, in fact, not even fully formed yet as Leopold was becoming schooled in it himself. And so he began to understand that we can't regard the natural world simply as a discrete collection of individual parts, that in fact it was a living, growing, changing, evolving community of life, and responding not only to its own internal workings, but to the way we live on and within it. And so he wrestled with these ideas, really from the very beginning of his career up until almost the last days of his life. And so it was a lifelong process of thinking through all of the complexities of, again, the science, as well as the ethical dimensions, and understanding the human, cultural, and historical dimensions of this. He understood that the science could only do so much for you. It could describe change. It could give you a picture of the world, but it couldn't tell you what you ought to do. That's the realm of ethics. That's the realm of our cultural mores and traditions. And so he was constantly mulling over that part of the formula as well. And finally, just in the last, the last year of his life, he came to this term that he thought would work well to convey this, again, to a general audience of readers, that we had to think of our community as something more than just the human community, but this broader community of life for which we bore responsibility and commitments. And the term he gave to that was the land ethic, a term that he felt that would be accessible to people who had not yet fully pondered some of these same questions.
We're talking about the film Green Fire, which is screening tonight at the State Land Office here in Santa Fe, starting at 6 o'clock. We'll talk more about the event a little later on. Let's go back to this question of sheep grazing and Leopold's family. Tell us about that whole history, Steve Dunsky.
I think one of the things that really appeals to people in the film is Leopold's personal story, his family life. And one of the things that people ask me, you know, what was the thing that distinguishes Leopold from some other conservationists? And one thing that I would just notice about him is that he's an extremely well-adjusted person. He had a great family life growing up in Iowa, and his relationship with his wife and his children, you know, by all accounts, was extremely healthy and quite, you know, he was just well adjusted all the way around, and part of that, I think, came from his marriage to Estella Bergere, who came from a very prominent Hispanic land grant family right there in Santa Fe. It's connected to the Luna family, the Otero family, names that'll be familiar to many of your listeners. And it was that marriage to Estella that I think really grounded him in many ways in all of the work that he did throughout his life. Now, the Estella Bergere Luna families were very much involved in sheep grazing. They were among the wealthiest and also the biggest landholders in the state of New Mexico. So there's this irony that although Leopold, who came in as a forest ranger and forest supervisor, attempting to get some management imposed on grazing, married into this sheep grazing family. But as we point out in the film, that relationship with Estella and with Estella's family gave Leopold, I think, a broader perspective of the other dimensions, the cultural and social dimensions of conservation. And I think it kind of gets at what Kurt was talking about, the land ethic, that you're not going to solve conservation problems with scientific research or with, you know, government management. You're only going to solve it by having good community relations. And I think that's one of the exciting things that's happening now in the field of conservation. And certainly in New Mexico, you're seeing efforts now to work collaboratively, people getting together to try to solve problems. And I think that's healthy for the community, and I think ultimately it'll be produce a much healthier landscape.
You speak in the film to a rancher who started at a certain point reading Aldo Leopold and was very happy to find his work because he'd been trying to figure it out by himself, and there it was. Leopold, more than a generation earlier, had already understood what he was trying to understand. And one of the things he said that I thought was so telling was he said, when we came here, we came to conquer this country, not to make it better. And that sense of their relationship to the land, conquest, as opposed to what do you want, whatever you want to call it, making it better, sustainable improvement, wise use. That's a real shift that we have yet as a nation to really go through.
Yeah, you're referring to our friend Sid Goodlow and his wife Cheryl, who ranch down by Corona, New Mexico. And those of your listeners who are in the ranching community or world, you'll know Sid Goodlow's name. He's been around New Mexico for quite a long time and has had quite an impact on people, not just in New Mexico, but even throughout the American West. He's really a remarkable land steward. And his story is so special because, again, yeah, he was trying to figure out, as he says in the film, trying to figure it out on his own, and he did. But then he found, when he came to Leopold, he realized that there were others who began to struggle with these same challenges back in Leopold's day. And so I like so much Sid's role in this because he's so typical of so many people who have come to Leopold at whatever point in their lives and found that Leopold, just like him, struggled very hard through many years and lots of ups and downs and mistakes along the way to find a better way. And as you say, we're still struggling. We still have a long way to go. But knowing that we have people like Leopold in our history to turn to and to learn from certainly has given me encouragement in my work over the years. And I think for many others, that's part of what they respond to in Leopold, that he, like them, was trying to put the pieces together and connect the dots. And you can't do it alone. You have to be part of a community of people who are thinking together and working together and acting together. And that's part of Leopold's legacy, is that spirit of constant work, but also working together in a way that gives support and encouragement along the way.
I'd like to add something, if I could, about our process in making the film. When we do our films, we don't simply write a script and go out and illustrate it. We tend to view it as something of a process of discovery. And we were very fortunate, of course, to have Kurt as our guide to this process of discovery. Kurt knew and knows many of the people in the film, and he led us to them, of course. But we didn't necessarily know what Sid's story was or other stories were going to be. We interviewed probably over 70 people, and unfortunately we weren't able to include all of those interviews in the show just for reasons of time. But some people stood out because their story really helped to illustrate some of the points that we were trying to make in the film, and I think that's one of the reasons why Sid has such a prominent role. He's done great work, and he's also a great spokesman for that work.
What is the nature of the work that he's done?
He, as he tells the story, you know, he was trained in a fairly classic, what you might think of as a classic range management curriculum, actually back in Texas, and so he arrived with all those tools, and a lot of them, of course, worked and are solid to this day, but again, a lot of it has changed in the last couple generations. The difference of looking at land as simply a place to raise livestock versus looking at land as a community that, if well managed and if its ecological health and processes are intact, will help produce healthy livestock, among many other benefits. So what Sid essentially was able to do was to break out, in a way, from sort of that classic paradigm that he had been raised in, to think about some of these greater complexities. In his case, the role of fire on the landscape and the relationship between fire and climate and grass and the livestock that depend on the grass. But also incorporating wildlife into his vision for how he manages a ranch. So when he looks at his place, he doesn't think of it as just a place that can be forced to raise more cattle. It is a place that will, if well managed, will yield cattle as well as clean water, scenery, healthy plant and animal communities, and that has that capacity for what Leopold called self-renewal in the land, what he called land health. And that's why Sid is such an exemplar of so many of the concepts that Leopold pioneered.
One of the things that Sid did was he, as Leopold did, he tried to understand the history of the landscape. And so he found these petroglyphs on his ranch that showed streams and fish and other evidence of much more abundant water in the, you know, not too distant past. And it kind of was an aha moment for him. He realized that this was not the way the land always was. And he realized that by bringing fire back in and eliminating a lot of the overgrown vegetation, that he could actually bring a lot of the water back to the land, which, of course, is very necessary for the sorts of things he wants to do, both with his grazing operation and also trying to improve wildlife habitat.
Scott Wilbur is sitting here with us from the New Mexico Land Conservancy, and you are also instrumental in getting ranchers on board with conservation kind of ways of thinking.
Absolutely, and I just wanted to also mention the important work that Sid Goodloe has done in land conservation through the land trust that he and Cheryl formed back in 1998. They really recognized how unplanned growth and development can really encroach upon ranching and agricultural land, and they got plugged into the land trust movement back in the late 90s and formed a small land trust in southeastern New Mexico and started working with family ranchers to put conservation easements over their land. And basically, for the listeners, easements are essentially legal agreements that are placed over the top of private land, which restrict development and subdivision in order to preserve the important conservation values that are on those subject lands, whether that be productive agricultural land or wildlife habitat or scenic open space or cultural historic resources.
But easements, you can keep ranching.
Absolutely.
On land that is under conservation easement.
That's correct. That's the beauty of the movement. It's a private, voluntary land conservation movement where landowners keep their land. They continue to own it, but they do give up those development rights through the easements, but they can continue to engage in farming and ranching and other traditional forms of land use. Sid was really instrumental in starting to get some dialogue going within the ag community about the importance of easements as a tool, both for conserving land, but also for hanging on to the family ranch. You know, a lot of ranch owners are oftentimes faced in their older years with having to deal with estate planning, and sometimes they feel like maybe the only option they have is to sell off part of the land in order to meet those state planning tax issues. But easements are a way to keep family land in the family and actually reduce the tax burden associated with those transfers of property from one generation to the next. And so it's a very important tool, and Sid did a lot of work trying to convince the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts here in New Mexico that, you know, ranchers didn't need to fear easements. He did it himself. He put an easement on his own land, and, you know, he's living proof that you can continue to manage a ranch and not have outside groups necessarily interfere in the day-to-day operations of your ranch.
We're talking to Scott Wilbur from the New Mexico Land Conservancy, Kurt Miney and Steve Dunsky, who are both associated with the film Greenfire, which is about Aldo Leopold and which is screening tonight at the State Land Office here in Santa Fe. So let's go back to the question of fire and the relationship between fire and the health of the land. Kurt or Steve, you want to talk about that a little bit?
I'll say something about that. You asked about why the Forest Service is involved in this film, and it's a little bit more complex than just the fact that Leopold was a Forest Service employee for a while. Back in the late 1980s, the Forest Service kind of hit a real crisis moment when there was a lot of concern about over-harvesting of trees, and there was a change in direction that was needed for the agency from the more traditional Gifford-Pinchot type of utilitarian conservation, which means sort of using natural resources for people, to a different paradigm. And the paradigm that was really adopted by the Forest Service was Aldo Leopold's land ethic. That was explicitly noted when we made the shift from multiple use management to ecosystem management. And I mention all that because the Forest Service has a very complex and convoluted relationship with fire. For, you know, 100 years now, we've been basically taking a European view of fire management, one that was imported with Gifford Pinchot when he studied in France and Germany and brought these ideas about forestry over to Yale and trained all these foresters that fire was bad. And when they saw Native American people lighting fires, they sort of dismissed that in not very kind terms. Not understanding that fire has a very different role to play in the arid West than it does in temperate climates like Northern Europe and New England. And so for the last 50 years, 60 years, you know, science has been telling us that we need to put fire back in the system or leave fire on the land in the West. Leopold was already figuring that out in the 1920s, but it's taken us a long time to catch up to that idea. And yet, we still really haven't gotten past that notion because of the fact that there are so many people now living in what we call the wild urban land or wildland urban interface. And so we have a very difficult time telling people that fire is good, especially after 60 years of Smokey Bear telling them that it's bad. I don't know exactly how we're going to get past that, but I think that green fire, and you'll note the use of the term green fire in the title, is also a complex idea, which we'll get into a little bit later, I think, in the show.
Yeah. But tell us why fire is good for the landscape.
Well, there are certain tree species, for example, that will only reproduce in the presence of fire. They have what are called serotonous cones. The seeds in the cones will only germinate in the presence of fire, as one example. In California, where I live, we have a huge problem, too, because we have the replacement of traditional forest types, which would be widely spaced pine trees, with these very overcrowded stands of fir trees. So it's not in the absence of fire, with the suppression of wildfire, you get a forest that is not typical of the particular landscape, and that can lead to all kinds of other problems, such as beetle infestations, large-scale wildfires that burn all the trees in an area, and also less water, because all those trees soak up a lot of the water that could be used for other purposes.
Let's talk now about the term green fire. Where did the name of the film come from?
Well, that's a long and complicated story, but one of the most famous essays that Leopold wrote, and it's kind of the center point of a Sand County Almanac, is called Thinking Like a Mountain. And it's a story that he wrote in, was it 1944, Kurt?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That was written at the urging of a friend of his because his friend felt that Leopold did not acknowledge the fact that his ideas had changed over time, that his thoughts about nature had evolved. And so he was urged to write this story about a time when he was just starting out his career with the Forest Service and an incident that happened on the Apache National Forest where he shot a wolf. And I'll let Kurt pick it up from there.
Well, at the time, it didn't leave too much of an impression, at least outward impression, on Leopold, but obviously the moment lodged with him because 35 years after the fact, he would sit down and write this essay in which he would describe the moment when he came upon this dying mother wolf, and he and his partners on the forest there went down and took a look at the wolf, and the wolf was still alive. Leopold observes the wolf, and he describes what he sees in the eyes of the dying wolf as this fierce green fire. And that image plainly burned itself into Leopold's own consciousness, because decades later, again, he would come back to that incident with the full force of his life now experience along the way to help him understand what it was that happened fully that day. Yeah, it wasn't just the killing of the wolf. It was an understanding now of the wolf's role within the natural ecosystem. The role of him as a human agent in the destruction of the wolf population of the Southwest, our growing understanding of predation, which, like fire, was a basically an ecological process, but one which we had in our culture learned to demonize. And so it wasn't an epiphany for Leopold. It was a moment of quiet lodging of in his own mind, and I suppose all of us as we grow up have moments like that we reflect on. And in Leopold's case, it took him again 35 years to sit down and write it. But that phrase and that essay as a whole has really captured people now ever since he wrote it in 1944. It's really become probably the best known essay Leopold ever penned, along with his essay The Land Ethic. And so it's a term rich with meaning and many different symbolic dimensions to it. So it certainly suited itself well for treatment on film, too.
It's interesting that Aldo Leopold was a hunter. He liked hunting, and it took him many years to understand the relationship between predators and game.
Exactly, and we're still learning those lessons. But the question of predation, again, like the question of fire, is one that we inherit a lot of cultural responses to, obviously, and different cultures have different responses to both phenomena. But there was very little science to inform that. And again, the science of ecology, as it is maturing through the early half of the first half of the 20th century, Leopold is really at the forefront of the new scientific understanding of this. And in fact, he and his students would become some of the first scientists to carefully examine the role of predators and the relationship between predator populations and prey populations, and how the entire system, in fact, is shaped by those relationships. Lessons that we're learning now in places like Yellowstone National Park, where wolves have been reintroduced, and we're seeing a whole series of what are called cascading effects throughout the ecosystem. So Leopold's essay is a beautiful piece of symbolic writing, but it's also deeply informed by the science of its day. But it's also very resonant now with all that we are learning still, and there's still a lot to learn about the role of predators. But if Leopold had not been a hunter, a lot of this would not have even occurred to him, because the hunter is himself, of course, a predator. And Leopold sympathizes perhaps in a way with the wolf, because they're both predators.
Right. So. Tell us about some of these cascade effects that have happened. We're dealing with the same set of issues here in New Mexico, where wolves have been reintroduced, but it's a very, very contentious problem that we have here, because people in the areas that they have been reintroduced are very much against that introduction and so on. What are these cascade effects that happen when you reintroduce wolves into an ecosystem that naturally has had them?
Without getting too technical about it, the phenomenon of what are called trophic cascades, trophic meaning what eats what out there in the world. Of course, all ecosystems are layered through their cascades, top predators, smaller predators, prey on down into the soil and water itself. And that's the entirety of what Leopold called the land community. So remove the top predators and you do have these series of cascading effects. The smaller predators will, in some cases, increase. But the real impacts are seen in the changing vegetation. In many places in the West where you don't have the large predators to control the herbivores put extra pressure on all different sorts of vegetation. It depends where you are and what system you're studying. But especially in, say, the Southwest, you're seeing a loss of the reproduction of cottonwoods and aspen and other trees that are heavily impacted by elk, white-tailed deer, and other large herbivores. So put the wolves back in, you have a depressing effect on their prey, and that allows the vegetation to respond, as well as all the other things that depend on that vegetation. Then even down into the soil and water level, you have, of course, impacts on how water works in the landscape and how soil holds the water or doesn't. And it was the connectivity across the whole community from top to bottom that Leopold really captured, and that he really deeply understood in a way that very few other people of his generation were able to see. Now, again, with the tools of modern science, we're able to measure and to quantify some of these changes. And again, at Yellowstone, for example, it's not just the depressing numbers, it's how it changes the behavior of herbivores in the landscape. It's not just, say, the lower numbers of elk or deer, but how the elk and deer move around the landscape, how they respond, whether they're sedentary or moving about the landscape. And so there's a lot of different complex chains in the, and links in the chain here that, that go into determining how the system as a whole functions.
We're talking about the film Green Fire, which is screening tonight at the State Land Office here in Santa Fe. One of the things that was so interesting to me about watching this film was the sense that every generation since Leopold, and he died in 1948, is relearning what Leopold already knew. And it's both encouraging that these ideas have such a lasting legacy, but also discouraging that we have to keep relearning them and that they haven't really yet taken root in mainstream thinking. We still live in a very much of a capitalist economic mindset that sees everything as a commodity rather than seeing it as a living ecosystem.
Steve, I think I'll let you take that one first. While I think
I don't know that I could express it any better than you just expressed it. I think you're right. I think that Leopold saw that. A couple of quotes come to mind. He said that conservation is the slow and laborious unfolding of a new relationship between people and land. He understood. I mean, he got discouraged in his life with the pace of conservation, and I think especially if he had lived to see the real boom in development in the post-World War II America, I think he would have been extremely alarmed and maybe quite disheartened by it. He was a hopeful person, but a lot of the things that he was fighting against actually came to pass in the succeeding decades. So we are learning these lessons slowly, and I think we're in sort of a race between our ability to evolve our land ethic collectively, our individually and collectively, our land ethic, and the tools that we have to destroy the planet. And we're in that race. You know, Leopold talks about the fact that we can crack the atom, but we haven't solved the oldest task in human history, to live on a piece of land without spoiling it. And we're clearly not there yet. I think there has been enormous, the modern environmental movement, which Leopold didn't live to see, but which he clearly influenced, is a hopeful sign. The fields of conservation biology that Kurt was just talking about, with the reintroduction of top predators, is a hopeful sign. Restoration ecology that Leopold pioneered is a hopeful science, and something that the Forest Service and other groups are actively engaged in. I think that's a very positive thing. The whole local food movement and sustainable agriculture, which Leopold certainly influenced, is a hopeful sign. But whether our ethics, our morals, will catch up with our technology and our political and economic system, I think is an open question.
There's another thing that I thought was really important that came out in the movie, which was the relationship between beauty and the health of the land. And of course, beauty is such a subjective thing in so many ways, but there is this strong sense of the aesthetic dimension of this whole question, which I think has some funny parallels in science and that Aldo Leopold was very much aware of.
Indeed. Aldo Leopold, even from the earliest age, as deeply interested as he was in the scientific approach to understanding the natural world, it was never separate from his aesthetic response to the world. And that reflects his family background and cultural background, but all through his life, he always kept these parts of his being connected and understood that they, in fact, fed each other and informed each other. So his sense of beauty, you might even say, evolved over his lifetime as he began to see the world in new and different ways. I think probably the most obvious example, and we demonstrate this in the film, is, just to choose one of many examples, is his response to a particular species, the sandhill crane, which, again, your listeners can go and watch down at Bosque del Apache, of course, a very famous spot for seeing cranes. But as he writes about the crane, he describes how it's not just the prettiness of the bird that he can understand and appreciate, but in fact this deeper sense of its beauty as you come to know its story as a species, as you appreciate that its lineage goes back 60 million years, that this species has been through ice ages many, many times over, and that you're not just seeing the bird, you're seeing its entire story as a species when you see the bird. And so that deeper sense of the beauty of any phenomenon in the natural world is one that Leopold really deeply absorbed through the science of ecology and evolutionary biology, and that he was able to convey to in new ways through his poetic language. So it's one of the most important dimensions of Leopold. There were others who had some of the same wisdom he did, but his ability to express it because of that sensitivity is really something that makes him a remarkable figure.
Didn't he call the cranes, correct me if I'm getting it wrong, but the trumpeters in the Symphony of Evolution?
Yeah, he describes the crane as the trumpet in the orchestra of evolution. He often used musical metaphors in his writing, and he really captured it. That phrase, I know, because I work a lot with cranes, as it turns out, is one that I could tell you that people resonate with that, so to speak.
You know, one of the things I think on both a kind of a scientific and an emotional level, which one can resonate to the film about, is the sense that no matter how bad it is, and soil erosion and everything else that Leopold saw, and overgrazing and things that we see, restoration is possible. And when you put your mind and energy toward land restoration, nature helps, and species come back, and water begins to flow, and all kinds of things happen. And it did give me a sense of hope that is fairly scarce these days.
I was talking to a colleague of mine just earlier today about the amount of abuse that that ecosystems can take, that nature can take, and still bounce back. The concept that's used a lot today is resilience, the idea of resilience, that systems can recover. And a lot of times our management efforts and our restoration efforts are really focused at trying to simply, and I use the word simply loosely here, but to try to restore or protect the resilience of the ecosystem so that it actually has the capacity to heal itself.
So we have this event going on tonight, and it's a wonderful event at the State Land Office here in New Mexico, Morgan Hall. It's at 6 o'clock. The film will start maybe an hour or so after that, but there's a reception and some presentations, and all the sponsors of the film will be there. It's at 310 Old Santa Fe Trail. Scott Wilbur, you're with the New Mexico Land Conservancy, one of the sponsors. Tell us more about this event.
Yeah, well, we were approached a couple of weeks ago by Buddy Huffaker, the executive director of Aldo Leopold, to see if we could help bring the film to Santa Fe. We had been a sponsor of the film down in Albuquerque, and we were actually thinking about what we might be able to do to celebrate Earth Day, which, of course, is Friday.
And right.
So this was a perfect opportunity that Buddy kind of dropped in our lap, and we were happy to, be part of the group of sponsors to pull this together. And I would like to real just quickly mention the different sponsors who are responsible for making this possible. In addition to the Aldo Leopold Foundation and the Forest Service and the State Land Office, we've got a number of local nonprofit partners, including our organization, the New Mexico Land Conservancy. We also have the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, the Audubon New Mexico, and the Earthworks Institute.
All fine organizations, I think all or most of whom have been on this show at
yes.
one time or another.
Yeah, and I think what's really great about this is we all bring something else to the conservation table. We in the Santa Fe Conservation Trust are focused more on protecting land, you know, the land preservation component, which is critical. I mean, you know, New Mexico is now ranked as one of the top 10 fastest growing states in the country. And, you know, we're losing something on the order of 50,000 acres of important land each year to unplanned growth and development. And so our mission is to try to preserve what is important about New Mexico. I think, you know, a lot of people have the impression that land trusts are trying to block growth and development. And I was at a social function a couple of weeks ago where somebody who had just moved here from Texas was asking me, well, you know, why are you guys trying to do that in a poor state like New Mexico where we need more development, more economic development? I said, well, it's not really that we're trying to block growth and development. It's just we want to make sure it occurs in appropriate places. We want smart growth. And we also need to really think about what is it that makes New Mexico unique and special. You know, we
and
obviously
sustainable.
And sustainable, absolutely. When we get into issues like food security and important ecosystem processes that we need to maintain, that's critical. So that's what we're trying to do, but through the Audubon, there's a lot of good environmental education work being done, and through Earthworks Institute, I mean, they're focused a lot on the ground restoration. So, like I said, I think we all bring something important to the table.
Scott Wilbur is Executive Director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy. Kurt Mina is Aldo Leopold's biographer. He's the author of Correction Lines, Essays on Land, Leopold, and Conservation, and he's the Director of Conservation Biology and History at the Center for Humans and Nature, and he is in the film Green Fire, which is screening tonight, and is one of the filmmakers who's been joining us this whole hour is Steve Dunsky. And once again, State Land Office, tonight, 6 o'clock, 310 Old Santa Fe Trail. If you want to get your tickets in advance, call the Lenzig 988-1234 or go to ticketssantafe.com, or you can make a donation at the door. Thank you all so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it was our pleasure.
Thank you. We really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks so much, and enjoy the film.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR.